I get it. You didn't click the link to listen to ads, so I'll be quick. I love coaching clinics. Whether I'm speaking at one or simply just attending, I love listening to coaches talk about how they do things while having the opportunity to connect with new coaches. At the same time, I have been able to connect with coaches all over the world through apps like Twitter, Facebook, and Instagram. And so many times I've had conversations with coaches and thought, I wish I could share this with other coaches. But then I had another thought. In the year 2020, why should a coach have to wait a couple months for the next great coaching clinic? If they're eager to learn, why can't we just put content at their fingertips? So we created the Film Room. The Film Room is our online education system for coaches that is designed to have everything in one place, from individual skill development and team drills to set plays and offensive and defensive systems. Our platform is a one-stop shop for coaches of all levels. And best of all, it's free with literally no strings attached. For more information, visit basketballcatalyst.com/filmroom. Welcome back. Thanks for joining me. You know, I realized last week that I don't think I've given an introduction for a while, and I probably shouldn't just assume that you automatically know who I am. So I'm Reed Osi. I'm the founder of Catalyst Training. And if for some unknown reason you want more information on me or my background, you can find that on our website, basketballcatalyst.com. But in all seriousness, I do have a video on my bio page where I talk about my entire story from my start in the business to where I am now and all the crazy stuff that's happened in between. But today is not about me. Today is about my guest, Courtney Douglas. Courtney played her college ball at the University of Michigan and spent time coaching at the Division I level before heading overseas to play in Israel, where her team is currently playing in the playoffs. And I remember being in college and one of my roommates and I were talking about a random player and he said, he has the it factor. I don't know what it is, but he just gets it. And I think that's how I would describe Courtney. She has the it factor. From suffering multiple knee injuries to having issues obtaining citizenship in Israel, Courtney's been forced to fight through an incredible amount of adversity throughout her career. We talk about her approach to walking through that adversity, and you can tell that she just gets it. We also talked about her thoughts on the state of women's basketball and how to grow the game's popularity. Courtney also works out with me in the summer and is oftentimes in groups with grown men that play in the NBA or overseas. She talks about that experience and she has some really thought-provoking takes on skill development and how she believes that we can help girls take the next step as basketball players. So, without anything more, here's Courtney Douglas. All right, I'd like to welcome on one of my favorite people on the planet, Courtney Douglas. Court, before we get started, I have this theory. It's really complex. I've thought it through. I want to throw it at you. So University of Michigan, I think they simply took a Wisconsin W, flipped it upside down, and changed the font for their logo. Give me your thoughts.
Oh, every Michigan fan is going to kill you when they hear you say that.
Well, that's what I say to all the Gopher fans. I'll like walk up to a random person that has a big M on their chest. I'm like, hey, did you get that on sale? They're like, no, why? And I'm like, well, the W's upside down and it's the wrong color red.
They probably hate you.
Yeah, which is funny because I'm not a Minnesota hater, but it is funny.
Man, and all the, like I said, all the Michigan fans, they just go crazy over stuff like that. Mm-hmm. Like, don't you disrespect the block M. Like, it's maize. It's not yellow. You know what I mean? Yep. I'm just like, oh, man.
My dad, my siblings all live in Columbus, Ohio, and they don't even talk about Michigan. They're like, oh, that state up there, or they don't even write the letter M. I think it's funny. So
that is hilarious. I got a good look into that because like one of my best friends from college and my roommate, mm-hmm. She came in with me, Carmen Reynolds. She's from Columbus. I got like a major inside look into that in college. I was like, oh wow, I did not get this rivalry before I came here, but now I completely get it. They go wild.
Oh,
they go wild.
The church that my dad goes to, they have the head pastor and like the youth pastor. And every year when Michigan and Ohio State play the football game, they have a bet and they make it known to the entire. So one year it was like the loser had to eat the hottest pepper like in on the planet, and they filmed it. And it was, and they showed at church, and it is hilarious. And then the other year,
that's awesome.
You got these grown men that have super hairy legs. They had to get their legs waxed, like up to the knee. And so, like, how funny is it when you go to this like waxing place and you walk in, and the guy comes in, and another dude, and they got a camera, and they're like, "All right, sorry, we're gonna film this because we got to show it to our church." And then the last
year, waxing their legs.
The last year, they took it a little too far. They had to eat like a hissing cockroach, and I was like, "Okay, Dad, I'm done. Quit sending me these videos." So that,
when I'd have to back out.
I was like, okay, like there's a line. I wasn't sure where the line was before, but we have officially crossed it.
You've drawn it at waxing the legs. That's where it stops.
Yeah, we'll stop it at waxing the legs. The hissing cockroach is a little excessive. But
no, thank you.
So yeah, so you're a Minnesota native. You know, you played at Chaska High School. Record setting career. All-time leader in points scored. I did my homework, 2,148.
Yeah, wow, Reed.
How many threes? Do you know how many threes you hit?
No, two? No. 212. Okay.
So you said off the air before that, yeah, I don't really like shooting threes. I don't know how the person at Chaska who's second all-time in threes would like hearing that. Considering
who's
that
first?
You. School record, 212 threes.
I still have it?
Well, at least you did.
Dang, Reed. See, this is how much I don't keep up with any of these statistics and records and any of. Here's the thing though, like all of this is going to get blown out by Mallory, who's there right now, Mallory Heyer. She's a stud. She's going to break all of these records.
And I'll be honest, maybe she did, but at the time at where I pulled these stats from, you were still in control. So therefore, okay. I cannot be held responsible for any inaccurate stats. But what I do know is that 2008, you were Miss Basketball in the state of Minnesota.
Yes.
So obviously playing at Chaska, give me a little bit of an idea of the landscape of girls basketball in Minnesota back then, and some of the players that you competed against, Taylor Hill. She around some of those girls. Give me a little bit of feedback.
Yeah, well, man, I don't know how much it's changed really, but like that. I mean, this is how long ago it was. Now is that there was no Chanhassen High School.
Yeah.
It was just Chaska. So everybody who lived out in that area, whether you lived like Chaska, Chan, Victoria, Carver, all those schools, they all went to Chaska. So we were a 4A school competing in the Lake Conference, which at the time like had so many great players. Like I talked about it with the head coach who's there now, Tara Seifert. She was our associate head coach when I was a senior. And it's just like every night you're like battling somebody who's going to a Division I school.
Yeah.
And if not a Division I school, like a couple going to Division II schools. And it was just so much fun. And so I think that's like what really prepared me to play at Michigan. But you know, when I got there, I think it had been we made it to the state tournament when I was a senior. And before that it had been 10 years since we had made it to the state tournament. So that was like, that was the only thing I cared about. I didn't care about like the points and the, whatever, the threes and all that stuff. Like I wanted to get back to the state tournament, and that's what we did. So, but yet, like, I'm trying to think. I mean, one of my best friends, Jenna Smith, she played at Kennedy. She ended up going to Illinois. She's a couple years older than me. But, yeah, Taylor Hill, she was obviously, like, the biggest name in the state at the time. Mm-hmm. She's a couple years younger than me. But I think even since then, though, the basketball has gotten even better. Like, there's just been more and more girls who are coming out and going to big-time programs and making an impact at those big-time programs. So it's been fun to see the evolution of women's basketball and men's basketball in the state of Minnesota.
You're a year younger than I am, but in that same time period, you know, Minnesota was the hockey state. So everyone, you're talking, you have one Division I school, University of Minnesota, but in hockey you have Duluth and Bemidji and St. Cloud and Mankato. Like you have all these Division I hockey programs, and they're just putting out tons of men's and women's hockey players that are competing at a national level. I mean, you're looking at their Division II and everything else, but in hockey, they're competing for Division I national championship. Yep. And so it's kind of been this shift. Not that hockey has gotten worse, but I think that boys and girls high school basketball really has started to peak and improve. You know, you said you obviously end up at Michigan in the same league, yeah, the Big Ten, as the hometown Gophers. You know, I know you and I have talked a little bit about that, maybe some, you know, your size being a little bit smaller. Talk to me a little bit about kind of your decision to go to Michigan, why you went to Michigan, and kind of what were some of the other schools that were in your final five?
Yeah, that was, I think you and I talked about this before, but that was like a really, not like defining moment for me, but I had this game. I can't remember. I think I was a junior at the time, and I knew Minnesota was there, and mm-hmm, they had never really been recruiting me hard.
Yeah.
Like they're, you know, they kind of stayed in the radar, but really, like, you know, they didn't even see me as an option to play on their team. But they decided to come to this game. Who knows? Maybe they're recruiting someone on the other team. I'm not really sure. But I think we ended up like winning. It was a big game. I ended up scoring like the most points I've ever scored, which was like over 40, like 43 points, 42, 43 points. And after the game, I guess she went up to the head coach and basically was like, yeah, like, you know, like great game, whatever, but she's just not big enough. Like she's not fast enough and she's not tall enough. And therefore, like, she'll never be a Gopher, basically. And like, that was like a defining moment for me because I was like, I'm going to prove them wrong.
Yeah.
Like this can go either one of two ways. Like either I give into that and I am too small and I'm too slow and all of those things, or I prove them wrong. And so I went the prove them wrong route. And I mean, I'm so happy I chose Michigan. I think you also asked me like where I kind of, my final three schools were Iowa, Iowa State, and Michigan.
Mm-hmm.
So that's kind of where I went on my official visits. We still did official visits back then. Now I'm not even sure they really players even get to that point. I just kind of felt like I wanted to be part of changing their culture and their program, and they had a new head coach. I loved the school. And I think in the end, it was definitely, it had like its ups and downs for sure, but it was the right school for me.
Well, you are somewhat unintentionally the third Big Ten alum we've had on from a different school. We had Jared Berger from Wisconsin. Last week we had Trevor Mbakwe from Minnesota, and now you being a Michigan grad. And you talked about changing the culture a little bit when you were there. You know, when I think of women's basketball from that standpoint, it's difficult for me to not immediately jump to the UConns or Tennessee, Baylor, Notre Dame. What was Big Ten women's basketball like when you got there in 2008, 2009?
Yeah, I think, I don't, correct me if I'm wrong, but I feel like the Big Ten has gone down since then, like women's wise. Like, I think there were some more powerhouses in the Big Ten as far as like on a national level.
Is that because you left?
I don't think, trust me, we were not on that national stage, but we tried. But, you know, like, I think that, you know, like Purdue was always up there. Michigan State was always up there. Ohio State had won like a crazy amount of Big Ten championships. Mm-hmm. And like every year consistently, we were having 6 to 7 teams like make the NCAA tournament. I think my year was the most ever, and we made, it was like 8 of our teams,
yeah,
8 of the 11 at the time made the NCAA tournament. But it was just like, man, it was a battle. Yeah. It was a freaking battle. And I talk about size, like I was for sure the smallest player in the Big Ten besides Fakara Malone, who played at Purdue, who is the strongest basketball player I've ever played against in my life. So it was just a battle. Like you had to be strong and you had to be smart to play in that conference. But like you said, still at that time, it's always the teams that you listed, the Baylors and UConns and Notre Dames. Like, you know, it always seems like they continue to stay at the top.
Yeah. No, I think there's a little bit more parity in college basketball, you know, on the men's and women's side. I actually, right before we got started, I saw a picture of Muffet McGraw with a, and she was standing next to Roy Williams. And so Notre Dame is struggling this year. And I think North Carolina men's basketball just lost six in a row.
And I saw that.
And the tweet had said, "Hey, Steve Kerr, we got a spot for you." Like this is, you know, like the former champions having a struggling year. I find it funny. You know, we talk, and this is a whole nother topic, but they said something the other day at a men's game. "Hey, there's so much parity. This is good for college basketball." And my dad goes, "But is it? Like, in the, on the men's side, do we really want a Final Four of Dayton, San Diego State?" It's true. Do we need, like, for women's basketball, like UConn, like they got, I think they got beat a couple times. So you're like, do we need, you kind of want a Final Four of like UConn, Baylor, South Carolina, like it's
Oregon now for sure.
Yeah.
That's a fun team to watch.
But it's goofy when
it is
like when, like North Carolina, like, yeah, they might be, I saw someone say they might be the unluckiest team in men's basketball history with their injuries and stuff like that. But it's funny, like it shows you how difficult it is to stay on top and to do a really good job. And one of the things that I want to segue into that is, so when you got done playing, you went to Northern Kentucky as an assistant. Did you go right away? Correct.
I did. So, I did go right away.
So
yeah.
You went with Dawn Plitz. Is it Plitzewhite? Is that how you say that?
It is. So, yep, Dawn Plitzewhite.
So she's your assistant at Michigan.
Correct.
And so you go there. Now, she is at South Dakota right now. They're in the Summit League. They're like 16th in the country. Like, I was talking to a buddy of mine today from South Dakota. He's like, "I don't know how much longer she's going to be there." So it's cool to see her have success kind of at a variety of different spots. But was coaching something that you always saw yourself doing?
It wasn't. It wasn't until Dawn talked me into it, because that's how Dawn rolls. that's what got me to Michigan. That's what got me to coach with her, is just like, she's super persuasive and convincing and in all the right ways. Mm-hmm. Like, that's what has made her such a good recruiter. Yeah. But her being successful at South Dakota does not surprise me in the slightest. I mean, that program was really good when she took over, mm-hmm. but man, she's like taking it to totally new heights, and it's not surprising at all. But no, like I really didn't see coaching in my future. I think I was always so locked in on playing. It's something like, it's a really hard job, as you know, like we've talked about how grueling it is.
Yes.
How much time, I think so many people don't understand. It's not just showing up to the games and like being there at practices. Like, you are working, you are traveling, you are recruiting, you are talking to kids constantly. And it can be super rewarding and also extremely tiring and exhausting. And there's so many good parts to it. And, but I just knew that, I mean, at the time it wasn't for me. Like I wanted to pursue my life outside of, well, at the time, my life outside of basketball. And then it just brought me closer to basketball, but, I don't know if I'll do it in the future, Reed. I'm not sure.
Yeah. No, I find it interesting because you're not the first person. So you end up going to play then after that. And I coached a kid named Jordan Reaver at Minnesota State Moorhead, who went and played overseas for 2 years, had an opportunity to come back and coach at his alma mater.
I worked out with him.
Yeah, you worked out with Jordan.
Yeah,
yep.
He's awesome.
And
yeah.
He's a great guy. So he goes and does that. And now he came back because his mom was sick and had some different things there. But he went and did it for a year. And he's like, "Yo, this ain't for me, man. I gotta get back overseas."
Yep.
And so you learn a lot. It's a great experience. But I ultimately think coaching, it's not – like, there's a lot of gray area. And I think most of life is gray. But in terms of coaching, I think it's black and white. It either fuels you or it burns you out. There's no real like in between, especially for competitive people. Like, I know like from what I know about you, like if I've never played soccer, if the two of us went and played a sport like soccer that we've maybe never played, like we'd probably look like two idiots running around whiffing on the
oh,
ball.
Yeah.
But like we're competitive and I don't think you can turn that off. And so from that standpoint, like if I'm going to be a coach, like I want to be as good a coach as I can and I can't shut that off. So if it doesn't fuel you, it's like, I got to get out. I have to go do something. Have to go do something else. You talk about playing overseas, though. It's difficult to get over there, obviously, because the WNBA plays at a different time. So we've talked about this. The WNBA plays in the summer, but you're playing right now in the winter, which allows some of those WNBA players to go over there and play. So you could be on a team and you could be better than most, if not all of the locals, but for a long stretch, you couldn't play. Tell me about that.
Yeah. I mean, so I moved out here for Stuart. So I like had no intention of playing basketball. Like I really just moved out here to be with him and support like his basketball career. And like, I had no idea that I could even play out here until a random friend of mine or someone I had met was like, "Hey, come to my practice." And I was like, "Oh, I think I can do this." And then I just kept like going to practices and then I got an agent and then I found out like I had to get citizenship. Well, the way that I got citizenship was through Stuart. I guess I should probably say Stuart's my husband, who also plays basketball in Israel. I should also mention that. And who also played at Michigan. But he, luckily enough, has citizenship in Israel through his mom. And so that's how he was able to come out here and play. And he's been playing like since he graduated from Michigan. So he's been playing a long time. And then it took forever, but I finally got my citizenship last January, which then allowed me the opportunity to play. But like you said, every league in every country is different, but here in Israel, we're allowed 3 foreign players. So that can either be like a European or an American. Yep. Here in this league, they always take Americans. Mm-hmm. So we have 3 Americans who come over. Everybody else on the team has to be Israeli. And then, so I finally just got my citizenship last January, which now I can play. So it's been like the craziest process. It took me like 4 years to get citizenship, but sometimes it can take people like even longer. So I'm just lucky that I actually got it. I still can't believe that it happened because when I first got here, it was like a pipe dream.
Yeah.
And somehow I've found myself here playing, you know, in the first division. And it's, you know, sometimes I like pinch myself because I just can't believe that it's actually worked out this way.
I think, you know, what's so to describe kind of the way it works, the players that you get from America are like the top players in the WNBA, correct? Like in the league.
Yeah. I wouldn't say the top. I mean, if we're speaking in Israel, yes. Like most of the top, mostly I would say what, like 85% of the WNBA comes overseas and plays.
Yep.
On my team currently, I have one player who's still playing in the WNBA, and then the other two like played before but are no longer playing in the WNBA. And then that's kind of the same for every other team in Israel. Some have enough money to get like 3 WNBA players, and obviously it sucks playing against them, but that's I guess kind of how it works.
Yeah. So if you like you go over and you're like, "Hey, I'm the best point guard out of this whole group," but they're bringing, man, I'm trying to think, like, or the Maya Moore's coming over. Diana Taurasi's
yeah, she only
coming
goes to China, but yeah.
But totally. So like, and obviously it's different, not just like to Israel, but
sure.
You know, you have, like, I've talked to some of the guys that I know that play overseas. They're like, you know, and I think this is a stretch, you know, exaggeration for point of emphasis, but they're like, "Reed, I would rather have you standing in the corner because I know you're going to get out of the way and maybe knock down an open shot, but they have to play because they're a local, and we have to try to find like the best locals. So you getting citizenship, excuse me, makes you a local. So now you go from like being a practice player and not allowed to play in games to, hey, Courtney's a team captain, right?
Yeah, that's exactly right. Which is also kind of crazy, but absolutely. I mean, and they do a lot here to develop the youth basketball, and there's quite a few players actually that go and play in college. But you're right. Like they would rather most times would rather have somebody like with college level playing experience than to necessarily have like a local younger local player here. So yeah, that does, you know, allow me the ability to be able to play and kind of, whereas I wouldn't be able to play as a normal American, non-WNBA player. So, yeah.
No, I find that stuff super fascinating. And I think you have a lot of people that don't necessarily understand how basketball overseas works. They're like, well, why don't they just sign these 42 Americans? Like, well, no, it doesn't work that way. And I know the conversations that we've had about just your journey and your process to get here. You know, you've gone through a lot of adversity. You've had a couple knee injuries. And you know, you mentioned that you got your citizenship last January.
Yeah.
And then you tore your knee up. Was it right before that or right after that?
Yeah. Right. I tore it like in December and then had surgery like January 27th or something of last year.
And so then you get the citizenship, and so it's like this, oh, like, hey, I finally got this, but holy smokes, like what terrible timing. Like, I remember how excited you were that you got, like, you have a picture on your Instagram. I've never seen a human being smile bigger than you are in this picture, like holding up your, like your passport. You know what I'm talking about? You're like, I did it. Like,
totally.
You have no idea what I did, but you know, and I need to tell you the conversations that we've had in the past, you know, while you were rehabbing, and I'm serious when I say this, it really inspired me to think about like some of the adversity that I've gone through differently. Because, you know, I remember last summer, you're not cleared yet, and I had one of my pro player invite runs going up at Heritage Christian, and you showed up and we walked through ball screen reads on the side. You know, you had every reason to sit around and feel sorry for yourself, but you didn't. You know, you've pushed through, you've invested so much time, you haven't played in a game, you finally get your passport, and you're not allowed to walk on a basketball court. You know, talk to me about like what's going through your head. Like, did I do all of this and now I'm never going to get to see the fruits of my labor? How do you go about that?
Yeah. I mean, when you put it that way, it's like, man, what am I doing? No, I'm just kidding. But no, I think you're right. Like at times especially like right when I had the injury, I felt like I was so close to playing, you know, finally. And I had that feeling so many times in the past, like in years past, when I thought I was close to getting my citizenship and then something would set me back. Not physically, just with the logistical side of things here. Mm-hmm. But then to have that knee injury, I was in a really bad place, I think. But to be honest, I, like Stuart said to me after my first knee injury, like I was broken after that one too. And I remember he said like, okay, you have like 2 days where you can wallow and you can be sad and you can cry and you can drink a bottle of wine at night if you want. And he goes, and then you're going to be done. And then you're going to do what you always do, which is work your ass off.
Yep.
And I thought about that, like with the second one. And that's what I did. I was sad for a couple of days. And then I remember like a month later, I got the news that I got my citizenship. And I'm like, this is exactly the motivation I need to get me through this injury. And the first doctor I saw was like, you're never going to be able to play basketball. Cause I did the, what they call like the trifecta, which is I tore my ACL and I tore both my meniscus and my MCL. So it's, you know, it's grueling. And
well, if you're going to do it, you might as well do them all, right?
Yeah, I guess just blow it out, right? But I think it's just, you know, you and I have talked about this. I think it's the way I was raised. I think it's what I went through growing up. And, you know, not a lot of people know what you or I have been through, like with our childhood and with our family situations. And mm-hmm. that's the stuff that I don't want to say it like fuels me, but I think it gives me that motivation, that fight, that I don't know where it comes from sometimes. But I'm so thankful that I have it. Some of the things were really hard to go through, but it gave me the ability to look at this knee injury as a blessing instead of something that was going to set me back. And now when I can step on a professional basketball court here in Israel after two knee surgeries and a lot of years, trying to get the citizenship, it makes me that much more grateful. And sometimes I look at other players and I just wonder, like, how can you complain about this? Like, yeah. How can you show up to practice every day? And I get it. Like, you're hurting, you're tired, you have this going on at home, you have that going on, and it's hard to be overseas. But I'm like, that you are so grateful, like, you're healthy and you're here and that you're able to do this, because it's not going to last forever. And I think that all those things in my life, and especially the injuries, have shown me that. So I always try to, no matter what happens, like, even if I get so mad about losing a game, that I just am so grateful to be where I am.
I think that the word that comes to my head there is journey. And I know that my dad and a lot of people that I talk to about these life things and difficult times is, hey, that's a part of your journey. And one thing that I was told by my dad is, sometimes I think the process is more important than the outcome, right? Because the process is what is going to shape you. And I know for a fact that there are a lot of things in my life, you know, that I've gone through adversity, that I'm not the same person as I once was. I joke, and this, not joke, but I talked to my dad the other day, and one of the greatest things that ever happened to me was my mom dying.
And when
say
it out loud is absurd, right?
Yeah, like, it's like my mom was my best friend, and like, it was the most painful experience that I've ever gone through, and I would not wish it on my worst enemy, but it changed me. I hope that I never go through anything like that ever again, but it changed me, and I'm thankful that it changed me. I wish I would do anything for there to be another thing that could have happened to me that it changed me. Just like you wish that, hey, I wish I didn't have to blow my knees out in order to get to this point of where I'm thankful, where I'm grateful for the opportunity. Because you've mentioned that before, talking with other players, where they're complaining and they're whining, and you're like, would you shut up? Like, I had to wait 8 years to get here. But it helps you, you know, deal with those situations, and it gives you perspective. But you talk about the competitiveness, and we talked about this before we came on the air. I had the opportunity to go down to St. Louis to watch my little sister Livy play volleyball. And I love her. I love watching her play, because she is so dang competitive, and she will run through a row of chairs. She will dive over the scores table. She's willing to do all of these things. And you said to me, like, Reed, it's crazy, because I think you either have it or you don't. And that competitiveness can drive you through the adversity. But if your lack of competitiveness can also drain you when that adversity comes.
Absolutely. I mean, it's so hard. Like, how can you pinpoint, what is it in Livy that, like, drives her to do that?
Yeah.
You know, like, it's so hard to say, or like, Reed, what is it? Like, you're one of, if not the most, like, hardest working people I know. And like, I think now, like, over the years that we've known each other, I understand why. Like, I will never fully understand why, but like, you can see that within people. Like, there's always these things that like define them or like make them a certain way. But it's like that inner drive and fire and competitiveness, like when it's next level, like it where does that come from? Yeah. It's so, isn't that crazy?
It's so fascinating. I'm the oldest of seven kids. So I have two biological sisters. I have two adopted sisters and two adopted brothers. Livy is adopted. She's 17 years old or turns. Yeah. She's 17 years old. And there's not an ounce of DNA in her that's in me. We are the same person when we step on the floor. I have two biological sisters that are like competitive, but we're nowhere even close to the same. Like, we're all raised by the same parents. We got a million different types of DNA with, you know, four different adopted kids, and we're all so different. And it's, I don't know what it is, because my dad and I are similar, but Livy's also similar. You talk about like your competitiveness, you know, and I'm going to talk about this in detail a little bit later, but like you walk into a gym and you got like, I won't say a name, but a former NBA guy, like 6'8", 270, and you're just like talking smack to him like, oh, is big boy wussing out? And I'm like looking
at
him.
Oh, come on. I don't do that.
No, and I'm like, Courtney's 5 foot nothing on the other side of the floor, and you just like, you can't shut it off. And I think it's funny.
Yeah, what is that, Reed? I don't know. I don't know. And you know what's funny? Like, you talk about like your family and stuff. And I mean, my mom, like growing up, you know, she's had the biggest influence on my life for sure. This woman does not have a competitive bone in her body. Like, it doesn't exist. And so like everybody, you know, and something like not a lot of people know about me, but like I'm open to share, is like I've never met my birth father. And so I don't, you know, I've just had all of these really strong women, my godmother, my grandma, like who have helped raise me, but none of them are competitive. I like, I have no idea where it comes from. I just don't. And that's why I think it's such an interesting topic to bring up, is where does this inner drive and fire come from? And like we said before, I think for everybody, it's just different.
Well, and I would love to hear, you know, a doctor of psychology or some talk about what exactly that is. I know like Livy's team upsets somebody this weekend, and I swear she could, I don't know volleyball terminology, but she could have 100 passes and 99 of them are great, and she shanked one. And it wasn't even, it wasn't like a routine. I mean, it was off to the side, and she shanked it. My dad looks at me and goes, oh, great, we're going to hear about that one at dinner for a half an hour. Like, because she can't shut it off. And that's a little bit how I am. Like, I'm sitting there talking with my dad and a family friend who was a high school assistant, and I'm talking about a stupid pass that I made when I was in ninth grade when I started in a varsity game. I was like, I was 14. That was 17 years ago. And they're like, dude, like, let it go. And I'm like, I can't. Or I'm like, hey, I jumped to make a pass and there wasn't anybody there, and so I flicked it behind my hand with my left hand and it ended up being a turnover and you took me out, but it hit the guy right in the hands. That's not my problem. He should have caught it. And they're like, dude, you're in eighth grade. Let it go. And I'm like, I can't let it go.
Yeah, we played a playoff game last night, and we were, just to give you this, I mean, we're up 20 going into halftime. We end up losing the game by 7 points. So obviously it was a debacle in the second half. And like all last night, I couldn't, it was so hard for me to go to sleep because I'm just thinking, I'm replaying. I think so many players go through that. And I've talked about this with Stuart, but like, I wish I was one of those players who just let it go, who just could. It's like one of those things where it's like, this is what has gotten me to this point, like this, not drive to be perfect. Sure. Maybe perfection isn't the right word, but but it also like has hurt me. And so how do you find that like happy medium between like, between finding that, that perfectness, that perfection that you're searching for? It's like so hard. But I like, I couldn't sleep. I was like, how am I going to get my brain to turn off? Like, how can I forget about this? And the only thing that helps me forget is just the next day when I'm able to go to practice, you know, and I'm like, okay, I can kind of, all right, we've moved on. We've watched the film. Like, okay, let's move on to the next game. But it's so hard. It's so hard. I really wish I was one of those players who could just turn it off.
Well, an example from this weekend was Livy's team won, and she was frustrated, and we found out later, she said, you know, there's different rotations, and I had to go get a couple balls. It's not my area. And she was frustrated from a team standpoint that they weren't clicking. It wasn't a selfish thing, but she sat down, and the guy who was with us, Eric Fallingstead, who's, he, you know, is a family friend of ours. He's like 35, and he, there's some trust with Livy and Eric. And I have a really cool picture. They're at the, in the football stadium in St. Louis, and Eric's sitting down cross-legged next to Livy. And he straight up told her, you look selfish. Now, and really? I love it, because there's very few people that have the ability to say that. And she responded well to it. He didn't say, you are selfish. He said, you look selfish because your team just won and you're ornery. So I understand why you're ornery. And I don't want to suffocate that. We need that. That's what's going to make you really good. But you have to understand how to channel this in appropriate ways. How do we channel this so that it drives you? He gave the example at his high school. He goes, we won a game. Our high school team doesn't win very many games. Our best player fouled out with 2 minutes to go. And so he wasn't on the floor. He was probably pissed off that it was a bad call. But the head coach was like, this is not about you.
Yep.
And so how do you take, but you can't suppress that competitiveness. So like you said, you're like, I wish I didn't have this. I disagree with you. I think that's what makes you really good. I think you, what you're really thinking about is, how do I channel this and not hang on to it? Because
yep.
Courtney Douglas is a chip on her shoulder, and that's what it's allowed her to play for so long.
No, and you're absolutely right. That's such, I haven't really looked at it like that before. See, this always happens when we talk, Reed. There's always that like one epiphany that happens when we talk, but it's so true. It's how can you like channel that energy in a better way? Mm-hmm. No, and trust me, like if we win, I tend to let that stuff go. It's with the losses that I just let it, you know, let it linger too long sometimes. But you're absolutely right. I need to find a way to channel it in a better way.
spending time as a college coach and being around like doing stuff with youth programs and high school programs now, it's so funny, not funny, but interesting to see how coaches do this. And Tyler Vaughn is a kid that I coached at Minnesota State Moorhead, and he's an assistant coach at St. Cloud State. Tyler scored like 3,300 points in high school. He got no Division I looks. He's like a 6-foot guard. He doesn't play above the rim, and he would tell you that he's not a great athlete, but he's incredibly competitive and confident. And we'd go have a meeting, and the boss would be like, Tyler's such a prick. And I'd be like, and thank God he's a prick, because he had 27 last night. We won the conference title for the first time in 32 years.
Right.
Like, and we joke like with Tyler, because Tyler and I still talk, and he'll send stuff. But that makes Tyler great. Because if he didn't have that, because he had a lot of people. It reminds me of you from what you said at the beginning. You're too short. You're not fast enough. They just tell you what you aren't. And he's like, screw you. I'm going to show you what I am. Now, in the process of doing that, did he come across looking like an ass every once in a while? 100%. But it's like, I'm going to take that Tyler Vaughn over the Tyler Vaughn that just sits here and mopes, because he probably can't play for us if that's how he plays. And guess what? He scored like 1,500 points in college and led them to an Elite Eight and was really, really good.
Wow. Every team needs like a mix of players though. You know, if you had like, you know, 10 Tyler Vaughns who are all pricks, you're gonna have a problem. And if you have 10 of the opposite, you're also gonna have a problem.
Yep.
So it's like you need that mix of like the confident with, you know, the role players, and like it's so interesting how that can like mold and fit together. But like you need those players. You really do. Even though they might bug you sometimes.
And Tyler led in high school at Bram. I think they set like a state record for the biggest comeback at Williams Arena in a game. Like they're down like 18 really? Or 18 or 20. But you know where that comes from? That comes from your leader going like, I don't have any quit in me. I don't care if you think I'm stupid. Yeah. I'm not quitting. And they go win a ball game. They have no business winning because of that.
Dang, that's mentality. Crazy.
Yeah. And so when you start looking over the years, if you were to track that, I would say that teams that had a guy like Tyler Vaughn probably win more games that they shouldn't than anybody else. Like, you're down 20, this game's over. Like, you know what? But we got Tyler, so we got a shot.
Yep.
And but as coaches, we get too caught up in like worrying about their attitude. Like, everybody talks about like Michael Jordan, and you know, he was this competitor. Like, if the Bulls wouldn't have won, I don't think that they'd have labeled him as a competitor. They'd have labeled him as a jerk and a prick and all of these things. But because he won, it's like it's different, right? Like, think about the crazy stories that have come out, like about Kobe Bryant, about like him taking all his teammates' shoes that were Kobe's and throwing them in the trash can after a game and saying, y'all are too soft. Like, imagine if Kobe Bryant would have been Giannis. Giannis has a signature shoe right now. He hasn't won a title. Like, he's one of the best players in the NBA, but what happens if that had been him? Like, oh, yeah, I'm on a mediocre team every year. I know the Bucks are good now, but if he'd have played 15 years and then threw everybody's shoe in the garbage, like, everyone would have been like, yo, he's an idiot. But now everyone's like,
who is this guy?
Oh, yeah. Kobe wins games, you know? Like, so as coaches, like, you even said it. Hey, if we win, we're a little bit more forgiving. I'm a little bit more forgiving of myself. But if we lose, not so much. I think that's interesting because I do think a lot of players that are competitive get labeled as something that they maybe aren't.
I agree with that. I do. I mean, I wish they didn't. I think, too, the hardest part, like you said, like from a coaching standpoint, is knowing how to, like, work with that player. Mm-hmm. And some coaches, it's like their way or the highway. They'll treat player X exactly like they'll treat player Y and player Z. You know what I'm saying? Like, that's one thing that I think, like, as coaches, people need to be better at is just recognizing, like, this player isn't going to react to me the same way that this other player will. And you have to find a way, like, with every personality. That's kind of the beauty of coaching, right? And working with people is, how can I get to this player? How can I help this player? Which in turn will help our team, which in turn is going to help me keep my job and keep my family happy. And so I think if we looked at it a little bit more like that, I think there'd be a lot of programs and people that are a lot better off.
Mm-hmm. My conversation with Eric, who was with us in St. Louis, he is as a high school principal. He goes, you know, I have to remind our staff, and I like to remind our staff, like, hey, you signed up for this to work with children, right? Like,
right.
Oh, this kid's being an idiot. Yeah, they're 9. Like, like, you know what I mean? Like, I don't know how many teachers I've talked to in my life. And I get it. Like, trust me, I understand the frustration. But it was so simple and so, like, hey, you know, you realize you did sign up to work with kids. And then you get pissed off when they do something stupid. Like, do they, you know, why do they do that? I don't know. Because they're 9.
Because they're a kid.
So, I think as coaches, like, that's one of the things that I try to challenge, like, coaches is, hey, instead of just getting pissed, how do you help that player channel some of that stuff in a positive way? How do you help them take their aggressiveness and turn it into, like, leadership attribute? Like, hey, lead this team and how to do all that stuff. I love that conversation, but I want to talk to you about just this concept of growing the women's game. And I'm passionate about it. I'm excited about it. But I'll be honest, when I think about the women's game in its current state, I have a tough time not thinking about Kobe Bryant and the work that he was doing to promote the women's game through Gigi. You know, he had Gigi working with a guy named Alex Bazell, who's engaged to Nafisa Collier with the Lynx, and he was working with Sabrina at Oregon, some of the top high school girls. But what I loved about Kobe's approach is he's Kobe Bryant. He could have got up on a pedestal and shouted, give them more money or give them better TV deals. But he didn't do that. He's like, we need to make the game more popular. I can't just sit on my pedestal and shout things. I need to put my boots on the ground and work. And so he went to work.
Yep.
And he was doing what he could. In my opinion, it seemed like he was like, hey, we're gonna put this team together. And one of the coolest things that I thought about, you know, after he and Gigi passed away was the fact that Gigi at her young age was willing to say like, okay, dad, like, let's do this. I'm willing to let you use me as the platform to help grow the women's game rather than just tweeting, give them more money, if that makes sense. You know what I mean? Because it's not that simple. Like, we have to increase the popularity of the sport. In your opinion, what are some, and this maybe is too deep of a question, but what are some things that you think that we can do better? Maybe some things that you've seen in Israel that they do well to help increase the popularity of the sport? Because you and I both know, like, they can hoop. You like the WNBA, and that's what I'm talking, and I say they, you, but you guys can hoop. So how do we do that? How do we increase the game?
Gosh, that's such a good question. And I've thought about this question so much, Reed, because I totally agree with you about, like, I remember when all this stuff was coming out about the players wanting more money. And, you know, obviously, like, the CPA, it went through, and, like, the contracts are better, the conditions are better, and all that stuff. It's so great. But I remember when all of that stuff was coming out, and, of course, I've played with WNBA players, you know, they're my friends. Like, of course I want them to get more money. Of course I want the WNBA to have better conditions. Of course I want to grow the women's game, but also I see it as a business. And the product that you, what's so hard about this is, like you said, like, they can play. I'm not in the WNBA, so I'm going to say they can play. Like, they truly can. And the product, I think, has gotten better and better and better. But the issue is, like, what is the popularity? Like, how many people are tuning in? How many people are coming to games? And I think you have those select teams where the fan – shoot, the Minnesota Lynx, dang. Like, that place is rocking. Yeah. Like, they love them, some women's basketball in Minnesota. And, you know, that goes, you know, around the league. I think there's, you know, Seattle probably has some great attendance. I mean, I'm sure – hopefully in Washington they do now if they're winning the title. But – it's like few and far between. So I'm asking the same question, like, how can we grow the game? I think they've done it by, I remember, like, when Skylar Diggins and Della Don came out, and they really tried to create, like, these stars, like, star players, so that people can, like, really follow.
Yeah.
Right. And people can, like, attach to, and then we can grow the game, like, through these women. And I think that kind of worked a little bit, because people started really following them. And it's the same thing in the NBA. Like, people really follow players. Like, they do follow teams, but it seems like the popularity is in the player.
Yep.
Or, you know, regardless of where LeBron plays, like, he plays for Cleveland or LA or whatever, they love LeBron.
Yeah.
And so I think the WNBA did kind of catch on to something there that I thought was really good. And now with the power of social media, so many of these players are, like, speaking out on social issues and things that they believe in, getting out in the community. Now a ton of these players are working in the NBA, which is really cool. I don't want to say a ton, but more and more are starting to work in the NBA.
Totally.
So I think that there have been some strides made. And like you said, it seems like now what's really cool is you're hearing about players in high school, Paige Beckers.
Yes.
Like, you're hearing about, you heard about Gigi, like, okay, so now I can start to follow these players and see where they go to college, see where they like are going to play in the WNBA. And that's the stuff that I think is going to grow the game, like from a younger age, that I think that that's going to really end up helping the league a lot.
I'm totally on board with you. I've talked with people, you know, and I could be way off on this, but think about the NBA, just the NBA versus the WNBA. You have, mm-hmm. you have like less than half the amount of games, and in the WNBA, and I think from I looked up, someone said the ticket prices were less, and the arenas aren't necessarily, they don't sell as many tickets. And so,
oh yeah, from putting it mildly,
yeah,
probably, yeah, and you so, know, like, come on, that's putting it nicely, Reed. Like sometimes you'll watch a game and there'll be like a couple hundred people there, right? Like,
yeah,
it, you know, I mean, sorry, keep going.
No, but so, yeah. But that's my point. Is that's not a knock. Like, oh yeah, get your stuff figured. It's like, no. If we need to, we're trying to create a more popular entertainment spot, right? And so we need to get people in the door, and so we need to create like this environment that hey, this is cool, this is what I want to do, like it's okay. Like think about, you have in like a commercial for something stupid like a website or a type of salsa or something, and you're like, hey, Tom Brady eats this type of salsa. Right? Like we utilize athletes to like, oh, that's cool, I want to do that. Or like, I want to wear these Nike or these Adidas shoes because so-and-so is my favorite player. And I think you're spot on with like having like these icons like Deladon and Taurasi and like all these people. Like I don't know very many people on the women's national soccer team, but I know Megan got up and spoke a lot this summer, right? And so,
yeah,
like,
sure did.
And so now you have somebody that people are like, "Hey, I know somebody on that team, or I like this person." Now, because you like that person, now that person has a platform. Now they get to go out completely. And they get to go talk about things. And now you're like, "Hey, wait a minute, that's cool. I want to do that." Now you get more people in the arenas. Supply and demand. Hey, demand is higher because it's more popular. How do we do that? I mean, I don't think we're coming up with necessarily an answer. But what I loved is that Kobe was trying to do that. Kobe Bryant could go spend his summer working with LeBron James and working with Giannis and all those. And he did. But he's like, hold up. We need footage of me with Sabrina and Nafisa.
Yep.
And we're going to make them icons in this game, and we're going to make it popular.
And they did.
Yes.
It really did. I also think it's good that that I think now, I'm not 100% sure on this, but I think now every WNBA team is affiliated with an NBA team. Maybe there's one that isn't. I can't remember, but I do think it's good that the NBA is helping. I think that that's great.
Yeah.
And I can't remember if I was talking to you about this, but maybe I was talking to Tuck. Shoot, I can't remember. But he's like, whoever I was talking about it was like, the WNBA has been in existence for like 21 years or 20 to 20, around 20 years, right? Like think of the NBA was nothing like 20 years after its existence.
Yes.
You know, it takes so much time to build like what the NBA is.
Yeah.
And so it's actually kind of impressive that it's still in existence now, and I think so many more people hopefully will take notice of it, because like you said, they can play, can for sure play, and let's just hope that, you know, the popularity of it increases.
Oh, I'm with you. When David Stern passed away, the NBA commissioner, they talked about like, yeah, he did some controversial things, but like the NBA games weren't even broadcast live. So you had to wait, like people on the West Coast would like get up at midnight and watch like a replay, because you didn't have ESPN.com. You didn't know who won, and it wasn't even popular enough. We just have this idea that, oh yeah, it was always that way. It wasn't. So I think you're absolutely right that there's a window here. But welcome to our society. We want everything now. Instant gratification. Hey, let's like let's start the XFL this weekend football, and let's hope within 2 weeks it's equally as big as the NFL. Like, not a chance, guys.
Yeah, what the heck is going on? I keep watching, like, I'll watch SportsCenter, whatever. It's like the nighttime SportsCenter at home, but, like, I'll watch it, you know, at 9, 10, 11 in the morning here. And they're showing XFL highlights. I'm like, what is going – the XFL is in existence. What is going on?
They came back. This weekend I saw
oh, man.
A guy – well, first of all, a team had a 9-point touchdown because they went for three. We're like, okay,
oh,
hold
yeah,
up.
I
you,
saw that.
You need someone with their doctorate degree in math – to be on the sidelines yeah. to tell you like what point you need to go for at what point in the game. But they had a guy who caught like a 60-yard touchdown, and the reporter runs on the field and they're like, what did you see there? And he's like, he just ran 60 yards full sprint. And he goes, I don't know. I got open. I got open touchdown. And I'm like, well, this is the XFL that the WWF of the 1990s wanted.
That's exactly right. That's so funny. Yeah, because they can do, like, in-game interview stuff, right? That's
oh, yeah.
That's kind of, like, the big draw. Is that what? Okay. That's so funny.
You can't, like, oh, man. It's, I don't even know what. Anyway, before we, like, we're not going to go XFL.
Let's not go off on that tangent.
Holy smokes. So we're talking about growing the game. We talked a little bit, you and I have had this conversation a bunch, about training. You know, and I want your thoughts on this. When I work with girls' basketball programs, they seem to always ask me how I'm going to adjust the workouts. Yet one of the most common statements that you hear when talking about a really talented player is, she plays like a guy. You know, I find it super interesting because
yeah.
I'll have people say like, no, this is our girls' team. Treat them differently because this is girls' basketball. Yet in the summer, you work out with me. You got Jordan Taylor, Nate Walters, Tuck, Royce White.
Oh, yeah.
And you're no different than them.
Everybody.
And actually, I like it because I think you push those guys to be better, whether it's a simple shooting drill or complicated footwork that you have and they don't. And I think it makes everyone better. But from a training standpoint, how do you think that we could maybe improve, or how have we screwed up the women's basketball training industry by making things different?
Well, maybe that's why there was, you know, such the big divide to begin with. Like, maybe we need to be combining boys with girls more than we are.
Yeah.
I mean, that maybe that's kind of where the issue began, but I guess here we are. And I'm so happy that you throw me. I remember, like, the first couple times I went, I felt like that intimidation factor a little bit. And then, like, as soon as – and Tuck. Like, Tuck's always somebody who's, like, driven me because he'll do something perfectly, like, the first time, and it pisses me off. And I'm like, this is not possible. Like, how does this dude do this? And then, of course, like, I have to work, like, four times harder than he does to, like, get it. But eventually I get it, and – I'm just so thankful, like, you do throw me in there, and there's people of all ages and skill levels. And you know what's funny is, like, sometimes I learn from a player that's, like, way better than me, but a lot of times I learn from a player that's not as well.
Yeah.
And so, like, I think, yeah, like, completely. And I think that that's what's really cool. And you talked about it a little bit, like, with Kobe, like, throwing Gigi in with, like, all of these different kinds of players. It's like, maybe she's not there yet, but maybe she will be, and yeah. That's okay. So just, that's where I think, like, we can be so much better, is like, okay, maybe they're not there, but who cares? Maybe it is a guy working with a girl, or maybe it's an NBA level player working with me, God knows why. But, like, there's always something to be learned, and no matter who you're working with, and that's the beauty, I think, of skill development. Mm-hmm. Is that it's outside this game setting where everything's set in stone, and there can be so much learned just in, like, the free for all of it. And I love the competitiveness of it. Like, every workout that you put us through is competitive.
Yeah.
And that's what I think, that's what's really, of course, like, the skills and everything, but, like, that's what I think sets it apart, is just, like, when they're different players, we're able to like feed off and learn off each other in a different way that I never would have in a workout with a whole group of girls. Mm-hmm. And not that there's anything wrong with that, but I think that there's something really special about that. And hopefully the guys I work out with feel the same way too.
I'm going to speak on behalf of them. Number one, as you said, like, oh, I was maybe a little nervous or anxious. That was never portrayed. And in the way that you handled yourself. No, I'm serious though. But also, I know that those guys, when you walk in the gym, they first of all, they know who you are. They know how you conduct yourself, which is the same reason why you're the captain of your team in year one, not being a big WNBA import, because they know how you handle yourself and how you go about your business. I think from the developmental side, post and perimeter footwork is oftentimes very universal. It just looks different when you're at different spots on the floor because we've been trained to look at things differently. So I can put you in a workout with Anthony Tucker, who's a 6'4 point guard who plays super slow. I can put you in with Jordan Taylor, who's like 6'2 and wants to just go fast. Royce White can be there at 6'8, 270. Like, it doesn't matter because we're going over similar footwork concepts. And you know me, that there's times where I'm like, hey, this might not be game-like, but there are game characteristics involved that we need to focus on that we can challenge people. I mean, for crying out loud, I work with the Egan Youth Program on Tuesday nights, and I had fifth grade boys going over the same advanced footwork that I work with Jake Lehman of the Timberwolves or Nate Walters or what, and they're in fourth grade. And a lot of people would say, hey, Reed, why would you do that? I'm like, because they're capable. And I think with the women's game, I think it's the same thing. I find it truly baffling is in the girls' game, like, you guys are taught to jump stop on everything. And a jump stop is not wrong, but I remember being a college coach.
No, don't get me started on the jump stop, Reed. I'm
walking to the training room with our head athletic trainer, and there is a soccer player ahead of us. And she had a t-shirt and yoga pants on. And the trainer looked at me and said, Reed, look at her hips. And I like looked up, and he goes, look at the angle from her hip to her knee. Because guess what? She's about 21 years old. Her hips have now opened up because that's what women's hips do. And I'm looking at her, and it was the first time I really noticed. I'm like, I'm surprised she is not tearing her ACL walking right now. But yet we teach a jump stop. I'm like, oh, jump stop's not wrong. But like every time somebody does it, I'm just like, dear Jesus.
It hurts me.
This person that is in the air right now, that they would just land softly and remain injury free. But that's just an example, and I know that you get fired up about that, but that where we just treat the women's game differently. Like, no, do this. I'm like, well, first of all, you and I know a 1-2 stop is going to be softer, but also if I'm trying to create separation, it's a quicker stop. I don't drift forward. We could sit here and list 42 different reasons why it's better and more efficient to do something else. But so many coaches are like, but Reed, this is the girls' game. I had a buddy I talked about in a podcast before, had a women's coach that was like, we don't throw one-handed passes and we jump stop everything. And they watch the game film, and he's like, dude, they threw 7 one-handed hook passes in the first half. They didn't jump stop anything. They stride stopped or speed stopped everything. Come on.
Oh, yeah.
You know why you guys win games? Because you don't do the stuff you teach them. Like, they're doing better, more efficient. They're using more efficient techniques. That's why you guys won the state title.
It's true, though. It's really true. I mean, I've had a bunch of different kinds of coaches. And one thing that I really loved about my college coach is that he always said, like, if it works for you, we're not going to change it. If it's something that we see is hindering you, hurting you, like, is not, you know what I'm saying, is affecting you negatively and our team negatively, that's when we're going to step in and say, like, here's a new way you can do it. And that's what I, like, always appreciated about, like, my coaching staff at Michigan, is that, you know, like things, you know, we had players on our team that did things maybe in a different way or not as like quote unquote fundamental way. But if it works, like
it works.
You've been doing it for 18 to 20 years. Like, what do you, you think changing like how you pass now is going to like, is going to be beneficial? Probably not, but maybe adjusting it a little bit to fit like what we're doing. Like that's a great idea. So, but to, oh yeah, don't get me started on the jump stop stuff.
My bad. Well, I do apologize for bringing up the jump stop topic. I had no idea that you were that it was going to start.
How rude.
World War III. But we do have some segments that we like to ask at the end. I love just kind of picking your brain real quickly. One of them, you know, with this podcast being called The Drawing Board, you know, it comes from the idea that when I was a college coach, whenever we needed to make an adjustment or something big, we said, hey, let's go back to the drawing board. So I think the answer to this question is super valuable, but how do you adjust when something isn't working? You know, what's your approach to that? One of the big things, the word that I use is audit. You know, how do you audit yourself?
Oh, that's a good question. I think I oftentimes actually go to the people around me that I trust the most or who are the closest to me. I kind of like use them as like a barometer, I guess. Like I do that a lot. I seek advice a lot and I ask a lot of questions. And then from there, I like I'm like, okay, does what they're saying make sense? Or I'll pick one thing from one person. But then from there, like I'll decide. And then basically my whole MO is just like work harder. That's like the one thing that I like latch on to generally. I'm trying to learn how to work smarter. But when something isn't going well, I'll seek that advice and then I'll take that in and learn from it and then see where I can like work harder in certain areas or now that I'm 30, work smarter.
Now that you're come on, I'm 31.
I know,
why you gotta take a shot like, oh yeah, now that I'm old as heck. Yikes. All right, favorite follow. We're big social media people here.
Oh boy,
it's how we, you know, for me personally, I connect with a lot of coaches and players, see a lot of awesome stuff, a lot of just terrible stuff. Doesn't have to be basketball related, but who's your favorite follow on social media and why?
Like that I follow?
Yeah.
Who's your? Or who follows me?
You.
Oh my God. Reed, I have been so bad at social media.
Let's
like.
Well, then it's simple. Be like, I don't know, at Coach OC or at Basketball Catalyst. Great.
Okay, yeah. Well, obviously you. Yes, you take number one. Actually, so I got to go like off the grid on this one. I have my teammate from last season. Her name's Lauren Goodwin.
Yeah.
Like, she's not even going to know that I say this about her, but she is she's playing in Turkey now. And some of the stuff that she posts is just hilarious. Yeah. She's just one of those people that like, I can watch her story like I haven't talked to her in months, like not since last season, and it still makes me laugh. So I don't know why I pick her, but obviously yes, Basketball Catalyst, of course. I think you've tagged me in the most amount of videos and pictures, so I got to give it to you.
You're welcome. So here, this will be a little bit easier since you're off the grid, living mm-hmm. in Israel. So 2020 comes from the phrase hindsight is 2020. You know, sports, specifically in basketball, has brought me so much in my life. You know, looking back, can you give us an example of someone that had a huge impact on your career that you maybe didn't notice at the time?
Ooh. I have to. This is like easy for me. Brian Fry. Best coach I've ever had, like hands down at any level that I've ever played basketball. He was an AAU coach of mine and he completely changed my life, really. Yeah. Like, I think I brought this up before and not to get too deep, but basketball does that, I guess. You know, I have never met my birth father and I had a hard time trusting men. Like, yep. I think that's one thing that I had a hard time with. And he's the first, like, you know, I call him my big brother now, but like, mm-hmm. he's the first guy that I think I truly trusted. And he made me work hard. He made me a better player, a better person. In fact, he's actually the one who took me on my official visits. He took me to Iowa State. He Wow. he brought me to Michigan. Yeah. That's how much, you know, like I grew to trust him, and he's still in my life today. Like he still lives in Minnesota. And like he for sure has had the absolute biggest impact on my life. And, you know, if it wasn't for basketball, would have never met him.
Yeah. That is awesome. That stuff is awesome. I feel like I've talked about the St. Louis trip that I just took a million times, but the reason Eric, our family friend that was there, is because my dad was his coach for 5 years, and then built into his life and just kept, you know, plugging away to the point where it's like, yeah, I met you when you were like 13, and now you're 35, 36, and you're still a vital role in each right. other's life just because of basketball, you know. And yeah. going into part two of that, I think, you know, the game has taught me so much about life, but given me my best friends. How's your time around the sport positively impacted your life outside of the gym?
Yeah, I think, well, for me, in an odd way, like Stuart brought me to Israel, which basketball brought Stuart to Israel, and moving to Israel has completely changed my life.
Yep.
I think it's the most defining, one of the most defining moments of my whole life is moving here, because it completely changed it, the way that I see the world. And I think that I'll say this till I die, that I think everybody should live out of the country for a period of time. Maybe not as long as me, but you know, six months, like just to see that, like we get so trapped in this bubble in America, and sort of move across the world and, you know, to have to meet new people, deal with a different language, different culture. Mm-hmm. It just, gosh, it made me really, really, really like just so grateful for everything we have in America. And then also like made me grateful for this country and a different culture. And I've been able to learn so much here. So I guess I would point to that move, and basketball brought me here. But yeah, like you said, gosh, all the friends and people that I've met that, you know, through basketball and sport, that's for sure one and a half. It's like a close second to this Israel move.
What I find super cool, like I'm not super close to a lot of the guys that I went to high school with. And yet, like last summer, before Anthony Tucker heads, you know, back to Asia, he's got a birthday party. And like the people that were there, like you're there, I'm there, Jordan Taylor, like Tyus Jones. Like Tyus Jones is like, I mean, what is Tyus now? Like 23? But the game of basketball, like not only was it some of you guys that were all connected because you basically grew up together in high school and playing hoops, but you got like how basketball just brings everybody together. And you're like, oh, that
isn't that
guy,
cool?
It's
like
so cool.
It's so cool, and we're all from different, like, okay, granted, we're all from Minnesota, but man, we come from completely different families, different backgrounds, like, different races, different religions. Like, that's what I find to be, like, so cool, and I still consider, like, Tuck and Jordan to be such good friends. I mean, and shit, I met you through them, so, like, I'm so grateful for that.
Yeah, no, I remember the first time you walked in the gym, Tuck's like, yo, I'm bringing Courtney. Like, all right, we'll make it work. I have to laugh.
We'll make it work.
I know. I'm like, yeah, this will be perfect. Like,
I know.
I laugh because one of the guys that I work out, Tyler Peterson, plays at South Dakota. He's a senior, and TP is awesome. But he was back home, and so he hit up one of his coaches, who's a buddy of mine, and he's like, hey man, I need to get some shots up. Do you know anybody? And he was like, well, I'm not allowed to set anything up, but I do have like one of the guys I know, Reed Osi, does a great job. You should go work him out, or you should go work with him. So TP hits me up. We're at Champlin, the same spot that you came to, and he was across the way, and I waved at him, and he kind of looked at me weird, and he comes over, and afterwards he calls his assistant coach, and he's like, yo, you didn't tell me it was going to be a short, stocky white dude with a comb over. And so gotten to know TP pretty well, and Gamelli was like, yo, man, like, I have white friends too. Like, so we laugh about that, like, because I do look like a little bit like an outside linebacker. So whenever somebody new's coming in, they're like, oh, yeah, that's Reed. Like, yo, it was really great. Workout was great. You didn't tell me he's a white dude with a comb over. So we
that's actually so funny.
We give TP, because I don't think he ever thought that would get back to me.
Great. That's so funny.
I can only imagine, like, when people walk in, they're like, oh, he's not 6'4 and skinny. They get a good
this
chuckle.
This is shocking. So,
are you a Minnesota, like, pro sports fan? Do you follow, like, or growing up, did you follow Minnesota sports?
No, I'm going to be totally honest. No.
Because I was going to say, we have the one of our segments is the Minnesota moment. Like, which terrible sports moment haunts you the most?
Oh, that's a good, like, I wish I could say I was, but, like, I just, we didn't, maybe it's a blessing that my family didn't really watch a ton of Minnesota sports.
Yeah, by the time the Lynx got good, you were overseas.
I was done, yeah, pretty much.
By the time the Lynx got good, learn to speak, Reed. All right.
I liked it.
Yeah. Who's the, we'll just, moving on, transitioning. Toughest player you've ever guarded or coached against?
I had to guard Taylor Hill when I was at Michigan. Like, we came up with this, like, scheme that we thought was going to work, because they had, like, these huge post players, and they had Taylor Hill and Samantha Perhalis. So we were like, okay, we're going to face guard Taylor Hill. We're going to face guard Samantha Perhalis. And Courtney, you're going to be the one who's going to face guard Taylor Hill. And I'm like, what?
Yeah.
Me? Uh-huh. Are you sure? Yeah, what? And it ended up, turns out I did a decent job because we ended up winning. I mean, Taylor still probably went off and she still hit a bunch of shots in my face, but we won. So
yeah.
I have to pick her. Her first step is just unbelievable. I mean, and then she became a shooter in college. Like, it was, and she grew, like, it was really hard. I'm sure here in Israel, we have some phenomenal players. And they just keep rolling them in. So talk to me next year. I'm sure it's going to be like, we'll see who it's going to be next year. But she was, for me, wow. That was like the biggest challenge defensively I think I've ever had.
I was looking at making a graphic for some promo stuff for this podcast, and I actually found a picture of you. I'm pretty sure face guarding Taylor Hill.
Oh, gosh.
And you guys are both, and I kind of looked at it, I'm like, oh, a couple Minnesota girls, but she's probably like, why are you, like, under my chin for 40 minutes? So our last question, who's your the best teammate or your favorite teammate you've ever played with?
Wow, and this is hard. This is really hard. I'm going to take it back to high school, actually. I played with this girl, her name is Brooke Brown. She ended up playing at UNI, but she came in, she's 2 years younger than me. I was a senior at Chaska, and she had that same, like, competitiveness that I had and still do, hopefully. But she was actually, like, athletic and tall, and I'm like, this girl, like, I was like, dang her, like, she's gonna be better than me, this is not okay. No. And in the end, like, we fit really well together, and I think it's one of the reasons we, like, made it to the state tournament my senior year. But we still, like, are good friends till this day. Like, we still see each other when I'm back in Minnesota and everything. But I know that's kind of an obscure one, but sometimes that's the way it is, you know. Sometimes it's not like the superstar or whatever, but
no.
I pick Brooke.
I love it. Well, this has been fun. You know, I love talking about how to make improvements. I think one of the things that I appreciate about you is when we have conversations, we're trying to find solutions. And one of those things today, obviously, trying to, hey, how do we make women's basketball better? How do we, as coaches, I know you're playing, but how do, as coaches, how are we challenged to do the right thing and handle players the right way? So I appreciate your insight on that. I appreciate you coming on. Best of luck in this next kind of stretch of games here in the playoffs, and we wish you luck. Look, I'll be honest. I don't want you to lose, but I'm looking forward to getting you back in the gym this summer.
Yeah. No, thank you for having me on. Like, as always, you know, you and I, we could do like a 4-hour podcast together probably. Oh,
trust me.
But we had to cut this short.
It doesn't even need to be basketball related. We could find something ridiculous to talk about. I don't know if anybody would listen to it, but
I don't think they would.
We'd have a good time. So
thank you.
Yep. Thanks for coming on. We'll talk soon.
Sounds good.
That was Courtney Douglas joining us from across the pond in Israel, where she plays professionally. Courtney's team is gearing up for a postseason run, so we want to wish her and her teammates the best of luck. This podcast is brought to you by The Film Room, a free coaches educational platform from Catalyst Training. For more information, visit basketballcatalyst.com/filmroom. Thanks for joining me. We'll see you next week.